We turn now to the towering figure of Saint Athanasius of Alexandria, the staunch defender of Nicene Orthodoxy and Bishop of Alexandria. He was born in 296, and he was present at Nicaea as a deacon of Bishop Alexander, but he was not a prominent or particularly significant participant in the Council of Nicaea. Much more prominent were Marcellus of Ankara, his later friend and a person whom he defends, a rather problematic figure. Poor Marcellus so defended the unity of God that he tended to speak in modalist and even Sabellian terms, and became a kind of an albatross around the neck of the Nicene party. He could be pointed to as someone whose views were obviously far too Nicene, and even pushing that position into a kind of heterodoxy. But Marcellus and Eustathius of Antioch were more prominent members and participants in the council, but Athanasius was there. He becomes Bishop of Alexandria in 328, and he remains in office for 48 years, and he is exiled 5 different times. The first 2 of his exiles are spent in the West, first in Trier and then in Rome. But then his exiles take place in Egypt, where he is literally on the run from the imperial police. In other words, for about 15 of his 45 years as bishop, he was not in possession of his see. He was outside of his diocese in exile. He's described as a father of the Greek church. However, he was a native Egyptian, and his first language would have been Coptic. This was one of his strengths. His strength was that he was close to the people. He came from a very poor background, and this is different from the Cappadocian fathers, whom we will see in the development of the Trinitarian theology, who are the staunch defenders of Athanasius, and those who are able to supply what one might say is shadowy and slightly weak in Athanasius' theology. Athanasius will emphasize and particularly prominently highlight the relationship between Christ and the Father, the unity between Christ and the Father, the identity of essence, so much so that in speaking of the oneness of God, he tends to lack a specific theological term to distinguish between the persons of the Blessed Trinity. That will be the contribution of the Cappadocian Fathers, as we shall see, who come from a very different and more privileged background. Athanasius is from a poor background. He is himself a Copt, an Egyptian. It's often said by a scholar such as Callistos Ware that Athanasius could never have resisted the emperor as he did except as a Copt, except as an Egyptian and a friend of the people. The people hide him during his exiles in Egypt. They will not reveal his location, even at cost to themselves, even at the loss of their lives. And he's a friend of monasticism, a friend of the developing and already developed monastic movement. He writes the great biography of Saint Antony, and does this in such a way that Antony's life as a monk can also become a model for all Christians, as we shall see. I should mention parenthetically that there have been some scholars who have challenged the Athanasian authorship of the life of Antony, but we will presume that Athanasius is the author of that book, and we will be looking at the biography of Antony from the perspective of Athanasius' authorship. We will look at primarily in the texts that are to be found below, the understanding of salvation, soteriology, from the perspective of theosis, or theopoiesis is the term that Athanasius uses, the notion that God became human so that we might be divinized. God entered into the human experience so that we might be saved through being utterly transformed, being remade, being made like God, being divinized is the term that he actually uses. And so Athanasius will conclude Christ must have been fully divine in order to effect this divinization. But before we look at these texts, let me mention 2 other aspects that we will not be looking at primary texts for. And the first is the notion of the term homoousios, which Nicaea defines or uses. There was suspicion, certainly suspicion by the Arians, but actually also some suspicion of this term by the Nicene party, the anti-Arian party, perhaps because of its origins in Gnostic and Sabellian circles. But the thing that makes this evident is the fact that Athanasius doesn't really use the term homoousios much at all from the time of the council until about 357. It's only from the late 350s that he and the anti-Arians, the Nicene party, begin to emphasize, become reconciled with, begin to point to the use of the term homoousios as the touchstone of orthodoxy. They've decided that this term, perhaps despite its origins, can in fact be used. The weak point, as I mentioned, in Athanasius' theology is that he lacks a specific term for the distinction between the persons of the Blessed Trinity. He emphasizes the oneness in essence of Christ and the Father, but a precise term to distinguish between the divine persons will come later, because for Athanasius, the terms hypostasis, which will later come through the Cappadocian influence primarily to mean person, and thus be a way of distinguishing between Father, Son, and Spirit, for Athanasius, the term hypostasis and ousia, or essence, are the same. He does not really distinguish between these terms. And having said that, let us turn to the texts that we have below us on this page, which are some of the examples of his soteriology, his understanding of salvation through theosis, through divinization. And the first is taken from the De Incarnatione, his great defense of an explanation of the incarnation as Christ, who is God, becoming human so that human beings might be divinized. He begins, "If we should wish to see God, who is invisible and not seen at all, we may know him from his works." This is an echo of notions that we've already seen, particularly in Irenaeus, and will be developed even further in the much later Byzantine tradition as the distinction between the energies and essence of God. But he continues on as we drop down into number two to say that by death, immortality has reached all. By the Word becoming man, providence has been known. And the giver and its giver and creator is the very Word of God. And then he concludes in number three with this ringing phrase that becomes so popular and is so frequently quoted throughout the later tradition, even in Latin by St. Thomas Aquinas. "For he was made human. He became human so that we might be made God. Autos and anthropesen, so that we might theopoi athomen, so that we might become deified, we might be made God." This term theopoiesis, divinization, often shortened to simply theosis, or also translated as divinization. "He manifested himself by a body that we might receive the idea, the ennoia of the unseen Father. And he endured the insolence of humankind that we might inherit immortality." He also uses the term apatheia in the following paragraph to describe God's impassibility. God cannot be harmed. Christ ultimately, in his essence, in his nature, cannot be changed or injured, and yet, mysteriously, he enters into suffering for our sake. Yet, he maintains his own quality of apatheia, of incapacity to be swept up and rendered not free. If we drop then down to the next text, which uses theosis, which is taken from his second discourse against the Arians, here he says, "If the Son had been a creature," which is the Arian assertion, "if the Son had been a creature, we would have remained mortal and not have been joined to God." One of his images for salvation, in addition to theopoiesis, divinization, is that we have been joined to God. We are united to God by Christ, who does not need to be joined since he is already God, since he is already one with God. So if the Son were a creature, it would not be possible for him to join humankind to God. Dropping down two paragraphs to the next highlighted text, being joined to God, no longer do we abide on the earth, where he is, we shall be also. Christ joins us to God, but it could not be, he says in number 70, it could not have happened if the Word had been a creature. For he himself must be there, the framer, the demiurge, the creator of all things, so that having renewed it as its framer, as its demiurge, its creator, he, Christ, might deify it in himself. For we would not have been deified if we'd been joined to a creature. And he continues on to use this term for deification, this theopoiesis, in the paragraphs that follow. We would not have been delivered from sin and the curse unless it had been human flesh which the Word had put on. Christ must have become fully human. He must have entered into our flesh. Otherwise, humanity, human flesh, could not have been deified. We could not be deified. So he intends through this to unite what is man by nature to him who is in the nature of the Godhead. And our salvation and deification is thus sure. If we drop down then to the final text from Discourse 3 against the Arians, and you'll notice that in each of these introductions I've placed an icon of the Transfiguration, a reminder of the fact that this doctrine of the divinization, the theosis of humankind, will in the later Greek tradition be particularly associated with this image of the Transfiguration, and understood as a kind of ongoing transformation by which the light of Tabor strikes us and enables us to become more and more what God intends us to be. If we drop down in this third section to number 23, being deified, this is a kind of a text which he places in the mouth of Christ, being deified by looking at me, at Christ, at us, at Christ's relationship with the Father, they will then have the bond of charity with each other. This divinization is also a participation in a bestowing of the charity, the love, which God has. And he's meditating here on the high priestly prayer, Christ's statement, you in me, Father, and I in you, let them be one. Athanasius is using this as a way of describing how salvation remakes us. He says, we become in God and God in us. We become one in him. And yet, this does not mean that we are the same as the Father. The Arians who say that we shall be as the Son are wrong, Athanasius says. The Son does not merely partake the Spirit, that he too may be in the Father. He already has it. He supplies it himself to all, and thus we are knit into the Godhead. One might say, in conclusion, that for Athanasius, the Arians term, which they will try to substitute, as we shall see, for the term homoousios, their term homoiousios, Christ is like the Father, he is like in essence to the Father, is not adequate, because for Athanasius, although he does not say this explicitly in these texts, the term homoiousios does not describe Christ's relationship with the Father. It much more closely describes what Christ imparts to us, a likeness to God. Christ is not homoiousios to the Father. He is not of a like or similar essence. Christ is of the same essence, and being thus, he can divinize us. And the Arians term, homoiousios, therefore, could be used to describe our relationship with God, but not Christ's relationship with God.